11, Western imperialism in the Middle East. Napoleon's occupation of Egypt between 1798 and 1801 marked the beginning of significant European military and political intervention in the Middle East. When I was first in Egypt and visiting the pyramids, one of the guides said to us, "Look at the Sphinx, he's lost his nose. It's because Napoleon's army did their artillery practice on the Sphinx." I don't know whether that's true, but that was the story. Later in the 19th century, European nations gained a foothold in the Middle East through trade and by offering loans, Suez Canal and all that. And individual countries set themselves up as guardians of the various Christian minorities in the Middle East. It is important to remember that the whole of the Muslim world, with the exception of Arabia, Turkey, Persia, and Afghanistan, came under Western colonial rule in one form or another in the period between 1800 and 1950. And even in these four countries, Western governments were actively involved in different ways. Britain's involvement in Afghanistan and Persia, for example, were all part of the strategy of keeping Russia out of Southeast Asia. There's a whole selection of my books up on the table there. One of them is by David Loyne, the BBC journalist. It's called Butcher and Bolt, and a description of 200 years of Western involvement in Afghanistan. 12, the Wahhabi movement. This movement is named after Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, who developed a strict puritanical and literalist version of Islam in Arabia before his death in 1791. The Saud family, who gained control of the whole of Arabia early in the 20th century, adopted this form of Islam, making it in effect the official brand of Islam for the whole country. It has been pointed out that it is an accident of history that the discovery of oil in Arabia and the alliance between the Wahhabis and the Saud family have ensured that this form of Islam, which might otherwise have been confined to one particular isolated area of Arabia, has now been exported all over the world. 13, the Arab Nahda. What is important to note here is that Syrian Christians, that is, in modern Syria and Lebanon, were prominent leaders of this movement, which began at the end of the 19th century. Not only did they want to assert a measure of independence for the Arabs over against their Turkish rulers, but they saw Arab nationalism as a way of ensuring escape from the dhimmi status and procuring equality for Christians alongside Muslims. 14, the creation of Israel. Developing as a response to anti-Semitism in Eastern Europe and inspired by leaders like Theodor Herzl with his book in 1896, The Jews' State, the Zionist movement deliberately sought sponsorship and protection from the British government and gained it through the Balfour Declaration of 1917. Thus, after Britain was given the mandate for Palestine after World War II, the Jewish community used the protection of the British to prepare for the establishment of the Jewish state. Avi Shlaim, the Israeli Jewish historian, describes the year of 1948 as, quote, "a year of Jewish triumph and Palestinian tragedy." In Arabic, 1948 is called the Al-Nakba, the catastrophe. For the Palestinians, 1948 did mark the most catastrophic defeat in their protracted fight against the Jewish national home. The trauma of defeat, dispersal, and exile seared itself into their collective memory. Many Arabs still view Israel as a bridgehead planted in their midst by Western powers, determined to keep Arabs divided and to frustrate their national ambitions. 15, we're nearly at the end of this list. Arab nationalism, as championed by Gamal Abdel Nasser after the coup of the Free Officers in Egypt in 1952, this movement was largely a response to the experience of colonial rule. Men and women across the Arab world, says Eugene Rogan, believed that the Egyptian president had a master plan for unifying the Arab people and leading them to a new age of independence and power. One of the reasons for the subsequent decline of Arab nationalism was that it did little or nothing to help the Palestinians in their conflict with Israel. 16, the Islamic Revolution in Iran. This was a highly significant development, since it was the first time in modern history that Shiites not only took over the government of a Muslim country, but created a completely new political system in which the supreme ruler had to be a legal authority. In trying to understand the events that led up to this revolution, it's sobering for British people and Americans to be aware of the role that our countries played in the events that led up to this revolution. I wonder how many of us are aware that in 1953, the CIA and MI6 engineered a coup which brought down the first democratically elected government under Mossadegh and brought the Shah back to rule the country. At the present time, it's important to understand that Sunnis in the Gulf and Saudi Arabia are desperately afraid of the new arc of Shiite power developing between Iran, Iraq, where the Shiites are firmly in control with Iran's help, Syria, and Hezbollah in Lebanon. 17, American domination in the Middle East. Let me at this point state what seems to most people to be blindingly obvious. America is the one and only superpower in the world today and has decisive influence in most international bodies like the United Nations. Its policies in the Middle East are largely determined by its own national interests, which include the maintenance of its hegemony in the region, its unquestioning support of the State of Israel, and safeguarding its main source of oil. 18, Islamism, Islamic terrorism, and the war on terror. In teaching and writing about this subject in recent years, I have tried to understand so-called Islamic terrorism as an expression of the anger of Muslims, and especially Arabs, against the West for its policies in the Muslim world. Thus, while it is necessary to understand the way violence is justified by Muslims on scriptural and theological grounds, it is also necessary for all of us in the West to ask the question, why are these people so angry? And do they have good reason to be angry? Part of the tragedy of the responses to 9/11, especially in the United States, was that few seemed willing or able to ask this question, and governments put all their energies into the war on terror. 19, the Arab Spring. What we have been witnessing in the last 6 months is a spontaneous protest against autocratic regimes, police states, corruption, poverty, and unemployment. While the main inspiration for these protests has not been religious, committed Muslims in every country have been involved in the protests. And because groups like the Muslim Brotherhood are highly organized with extensive networks, they have been finding ways to take political advantage of the situation. Needs to be said that we are going to be very disappointed if we expect Arab countries to develop suddenly into Western-style democracies. And Christians especially must reconcile themselves to the fact that Islam is bound to have quite a significant role in every constitution. I trust also that we are aware that there is a very fierce struggle going on at the moment between moderate Muslims and more extremist Muslims for leadership of these governments. We now go on to some general conclusions. One, history is important. Attitudes today are affected by 1,400 years of difficult relationships. When I taught Christian students from Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Palestine, Armenia, Iran, and the Sudan at the Near East School of Theology, I had to remind myself constantly that these were people whose forefathers and mothers had lived under the rule of Islam for centuries, and who in some cases, especially the Armenians, the Iranians, and the Sudanese, had not had good experiences of Muslims and Islam. I remember distinctly one of my students, who was a Maronite actually, told me once that he saw his uncle being shot in the street during the Civil War. And once at the end of term, we were sitting at a lunch table, he was at the other end of the table, and he said in quite a loud voice to the person sitting opposite him, and they were discussing the courses that they were going to take the following semester. He said in quite a loud voice, probably intending me to hear, "Be careful of Chapman's courses. He likes Muslims." Muslims, for their part, have lived for around 13 centuries with the assumption that Islam must rule. In Arabic, it's al-Islam la-budda an yahkum, and have felt it utterly natural that Muslims should rule over Christians. They have therefore found it very hard to accept the last two centuries in which Western Christian quote-unquote powers have effectively been ruling over them. Two, we are living with the consequences of the way Western powers carved up the Middle East after the fall of the Ottoman Empire. The best explanation I have found of the significance of these recent developments in the region since the beginning of the 20th century is from a Jordanian-American journalist, Rami Khoury, and it's the, I think, the last of the handouts that you've got. I would love to read two paragraphs in particular, but I'm not going to because it would take too much time, but it's a brilliant article written in February. It's from an Arab explaining his understanding of the significance of these events. And it all has to be understood against the background of what Britain and France did after the First World War in carving up the Middle East into different spheres of influence. And I recommend one particular book called The Peace to End All Peace, which is on the table there. Number three. It's almost impossible to separate religion from politics. Christian history began with the crucifixion and the catacombs, but has included Armenia, the first Christian state, Byzantium, and European Christendom. So, however hard Western Protestants today want to separate church and state, the Constantinian model is part of our history. In Islam, an indissoluble link between religion and politics began with the Hijra, and the creation of the first Islamic state in Medina, in which, as has been said, Muhammad became his own Constantine. If therefore we ask why so many Muslims seem to be politically motivated and why many are insistent on the principle of deen wa dawla, religion and state, part of the answer must lie in the very origins of Islam and Muhammad being both prophet and statesman. For both Christianity and Islam see themselves as universal missionary religions. I'll leave that out. Number five, churches can die. One of the many strengths of Jenkins' book is the way it reminds us of the fact that the Eastern churches flourished and spread centuries before many of our churches came into existence in Europe, but that many of these churches have experienced severe decline or been completely extinguished. He writes, "This older Christian world perished, destroyed so comprehensively that its memory is forgotten by all except academic specialists. Theologians seldom address the troubling questions raised by the destruction of churches and Christian communities." End quote. So if in some places and at certain times the blood of the martyrs has been the seed of the church, in other places and at other times, it has been the death of the church. Now listen to these statistics. The population of Asia Minor in 1050 were nearly all Christians. But by 1450, Christians were only 10 or 15% of the population. Between 1200 and 1500, the number of Asian Christians fell from 21 million to 3.4 million. It is sobering for us to be reminded that as late as 1900, Christians were still around 11% of the population throughout the whole of the Middle East and 46% of the Ottoman Empire. Jenkins concludes, for practical purposes, Middle Eastern Christianity has, within living memory, all but disappeared as a living force. Six, we need to separate factors related to Islam from those which have nothing to do with Islam. Another strength of Jenkins' book is that while he recognizes the significant role of pressure, if not persecution, from Muslim authorities, which led to the decline of the church, he insists that all the blame cannot be laid on Muslims and Islam. Quote, "In stressing the role of conflict with Islam, we should not exaggerate the intolerant or militaristic nature of that religion. He is at pains to point out the many other factors which contributed to this decline, which had nothing whatsoever to do with Islam, such as the weakness of the churches, from theological, cultural, and political division, failure to contextualize, isolationism, association with particular authorities, the general culture of cruelty, climate change and geography, the scapegoating of minorities at times of difficulty, economic hardship, social breakdown, population transfers, emigration and immigration, and political threats from outside powers. Number seven, some patterns in history repeat themselves. Muslims see the foreign policies in the West, of the West in recent years, which they perceive as the Christian West, as a repetition of the pattern of the Crusades, in which the Christian West waged war on the Muslim East. Islamist rhetoric has consistently seen the Iraq War and the war against terror as a continuation of the Crusades. Is there not an element of truth in this perception? A second pattern that can be discerned is that, in the words of Jenkins, a church that allied with the wrong nation or faction could make its own position worse as it became identified with the wrong side. This is what happened with those Christians in Mesopotamian China who came to be seen as tools of the Mongol conquerors. A third example is that persecution can sometimes be caused by political rather than religious factors, and this may help us to understand some of the present persecution of Christians in the region. It's got something here about the Armenian genocide, but I'll leave that out. At this point, I've got quite a lot more, but can I just give you a minute to talk to your neighbour to respond to what you've heard so far, if there's anything new or shocking in what I've said. Just 1 minute or so before we continue from here.